This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. This week, Sports Illustrated features excerpts from a new book titled Game of Shadows by journalists Mark Fainaru-Wada and Lance Williams. The authors contend that Barry Bonds decided to use illegal performance-enhancing drugs in 1998 because he was angry at the attention Mark McGwire was getting. Using interviews with a former girlfriend and records seized in raids on the Balco Lab in California, Fainaru-Wada and Williams contend that Barry Bonds used the drugs for 5 years, including the season during which he hit a record-breaking 73 home runs. Associated Press columnist Jim Litke is among those impressed by Game of Shadows.
It's put together so well, and it's put together in such an easy-to-grasp fashion. I mean, a lot of the news was coming out in piecemeal fashion prior to this, and so, you know, there were gaps in the knowledge. This book provides calendars with a schedule with the abbreviations of specific drugs. It provides just such a thorough, you know, forward-looking glimpse of how this guy was getting through the last 5 years that I don't see how anybody at this point other than Barry Bonds is going to deny it.
Like Jim Litke, most of the journalists who've been covering baseball steroid stories in general, and in particular the alleged involvement of Barry Bonds, were already inclined to believe Bonds had used performance-enhancing drugs. Jennifer Floyd Engel, who writes for the Star-Telegram in Dallas, is among them.
I think it just backed up what I already thought about him, but I think what it did do is put some real hard evidence and proof behind the things that I had felt in my gut, and I'm pretty sure that he did steroids and he took performance-enhancing drugs, and as a result, I don't think he should be playing baseball anymore, and I don't think he should be honored in the Hall of Fame one day.
Well, I'm wrestling with that right now. So I'm probably a good person to ask.
Jason Stark writes and talks about baseball for ESPN.
You know, it's been my position when we looked at this whole generation of players, baseball gave us as voters absolutely no evidence. They didn't test. They looked the other way. Whatever went on was allowed to go on for years and years and years. So what do we do? I for one, feel as though I'm happy that there's going to be a lot of years between this book coming out and the ballot arriving in my hand, because I still have a feeling Barry's not finished with his IRS issues. He may be hearing again from the Balco grand jury about possible perjury charges. There's a lot of developments in this story to come, I think.
Joining me now to comment on Barry Bonds and some actual baseball as well is ESPN's Tim Kirkjian. Tim, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thank you very much, Bill.
Fainaru-Wada and Lance Williams maintain that Barry Bonds used steroids because he was not satisfied to be a Hall of Fame ballplayer. He wanted to be better than everybody else and get the attention that that distinction demands. If that's true, Tim, to what extent is Bonds representative of major leaguers in particular and pro athletes in general?
Well, there's something very, very admirable about wanting to be the best under any circumstances. However, if he's doing it solely from jealousy and greed, I have a real problem with this, Bill. After the 1998 season, when McGwire hit the 70 homers, there isn't one person in baseball who would have told you that Mark McGwire was a better all-round player than Barry Bonds. Barry Bonds was the best player in the game after the 98 season, and yet he still, according to this story, felt the need to do more than that. And the unfortunate part for him on some level is he went away from the all-round player and just became this muscle slugger. He lost some of his speed, he stopped running, and he just hit home runs. And it's he didn't need to do that, and that really doesn't sit very well with me.
Tim, let's talk a little bit about the World Baseball Classic. Does this week's round one action magnificently increase the popularity of baseball in Canada?
Well, that was a really great thing for Canada, and I know that was an upset, and I never use the word upset when it comes to baseball. However, you know, people who say, how could the Canadians beat us? You know, they have some A-ball players on their team. Well, quite honestly, the Kansas City Royals a couple years ago had some A-ball guys on their major league team and went in and swept the New York Yankees 3 games in a row, not just one. So I didn't see it as quite the stunning upset that everybody did. It was a surprise. It wasn't a shock.
We ran a story on last week's program in which it was suggested that South Africa could play the role of spoiler when it met the U.S. in round one, but that didn't quite happen, did it?
No, it didn't, and just as well, because as much as I say baseball is the best game because on any given day you can beat anyone and the Royals can sweep the Yankees, South Africa isn't even close. South Africa might be the worst team in the whole tournament. They have a guy named Jonathan Phillips on their team who's probably a good kid and a great high school player, but he got released out of A-ball by the Brewers, and now he's playing for the South African team. And with the United States, especially after what happened against Canada, it appears they were a little bit angry about losing that game because they came out and mercied it pretty quickly.
Cuba, Venezuela, the Dominican Republic, Japan, Korea, Mexico, Puerto Rico, and the U.S. have now advanced to round two, which begins tomorrow. Any real surprises?
You know, I don't see those were basically the key teams in all of it. And I think this is going to come down to really one of maybe three teams, Venezuela, the Dominican, and the United States. Although my friend Peter Gammons picked the Japanese to win this thing, and others have really liked that Puerto Rican team. There are some really good teams out there, and I saw Mexico play, and please don't tell me Mexico doesn't have a good team. They gave the United States all they could handle there for a while.
You mentioned virtually all of the remaining teams as a terrific bunch of fellas and real contenders, so I'm going to put you on the spot. You going to pick a winner?
I am taking the United States in the championship game against the Dominican Republic. I'm on record with that because I thought the United States had the best bullpen. And let's face it, with pitch limits and everything else, the bullpen is going to be the most important thing. Now, that was before Billy Wagner pulled out. But I'm still going with the United States. I'm still going on strength of bullpen. But if one of three other teams wins, it would not shock me.
Tim Kirchen is covering the World Baseball Classic, Major League Baseball, spring training, and the possible presence of water, hence baseball, on one of the moons of Jupiter for ESPN. He's our classical baseball guy here on Only a Game. Thanks again, Tim.
Thank you, Bill.
There's been a lot of attention paid to the Dominican Republic's power at the plate, the political intrigue surrounding the Cuban team, and the shaky waltz of the U.S. through round one of the World Baseball Classic. But Mexico has been largely overlooked, despite a roster loaded with 21 major leaguers and the team's status as Pool B winner. As Arizona Public Radio's Daniel Crocker reports, Mexico's players feel they have as much to prove to their own country as they do to the rest of the world.
Mexicans have played baseball since the 1840s, when American troops first introduced the sport. But in most of the country, soccer is still king. That's a perception that Miguel Ojeda, a catcher for the Colorado Rockies, hopes the World Baseball Classic will change.
I think that there's a lot of people down in Mexico that don't believe baseball is our number one sport. They believe in soccer. So for us, it's a big opportunity to prove those guys, the fans in Mexico. You know, people that don't believe in baseball, people that don't go to baseball fields because they don't think that it is the bigger sport. I think that this is our chance. This is our opportunity.
Ojeda says Mexico no longer has anything to prove to the rest of the world. In 2003, Mexico beat the U.S. in Olympic qualifying play, which kept the U.S. out of the 2004 Summer Games in Athens. Last year, many of these same players won the Caribbean World Series, which brings together the champions from the Winter Leagues in Mexico, Venezuela, Puerto Rico, and the Dominican Republic. Again, Miguel Ojeda.
They know that our baseball has grown a lot. Before, and on the Caribbean Series, they thought that we were the underdog. Now they don't feel that way. Now they know we can beat anybody. They're more aware of us than they were before.
Ojeda says Mexico's success in the World Baseball Classic won't be solely based on wins and losses, but on the response of Mexico's fans. Judging by the team's opening game against the United States at Chase Field in Phoenix Tuesday, they've already won. More than 30,000 raucous fans jammed the stadium's two lower decks. At least half were Mexico supporters, dressed in red and green, many draped in Mexican flags. Abel Maldonado waved a hand-lettered sign proclaiming what he thinks is Mexico's number one sport.
My sign means, you know, usually in Mexico, soccer is a big sport, but in North Mexico, we really like baseball. And this means, to me, baseball is number one. I'm tired of soccer. I like baseball. I say, viva baseball.
Maldonado lives in Phoenix now. He says baseball's popularity has grown in Mexico over the past 15 years. He says that's due in part to the success of players like Vinny Castilla. The Padres' third baseman is the all-time leader in hits, homers, and RBI among all Mexicans who have played in the majors. But Maldonado says it all started with Fernando Valenzuela.
He's the guy who opened the door for a lot of Mexican players, you know. They open the door for a lot of Mexican guys.
Coach number 34, Fernando Valenzuela.
Mexican fans clearly still revere the former Cy Young Award winner. Valenzuela is the World Baseball Classic team's pitching coach. Pitching is still Mexico's strength 25 years after Valenzuela won his World Series ring with the Dodgers. Rodrigo Lopez, the team's number one starter, won 15 games for the Orioles last year. But Esteban Loaiza is probably most well-known, judging from the throng of autograph seekers before Tuesday's game against the U.S.
Could you sign this in the sweet spot?
Yeah, I'll sign it on the sweet spot. Hold on.
Oh, thank you. I didn't get any.
Okay.
My favorite pitcher. Can you write WBC under it?
Make sure your dad doesn't put it on eBay.
Loaiza agreed the Classic is an important event for Mexican baseball.
It's a big thing, you know, especially for us. In Mexico, you know, all south of Mexico, it's just soccer. And now doing this and being this classic with a good team that we have, and us playing against the United States today, it's going to be really more important for us, you know, to give them a battle.
Mexico did give the U.S. a battle, losing 2-0 on a pair of solo homers by Derek Lee and Chipper Jones. Starting pitcher Rodrigo Lopez gave up only 3 hits in 4 innings, but still took the loss. After the game, Lopez said his team proved something by playing the Americans close.
They don't show that much respect for Mexican baseball in our country, so it's time to us to prove that it's a good level in Mexico, and I think showing people that we can play against teams like USA, make a good game, hopefully that can help to Mexican baseball.
Mexican baseball certainly looked formidable after the tight loss to the U.S. Mexico thumped South Africa 10-4 and Canada 9-1 in one Pool B. The team will face Korea tomorrow as Round 2 begins in Anaheim. For Only a Game, I'm Daniel Crocker in Phoenix.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. I'm Bill Littlefield, coming up on Only a Game, the ongoing development of the NBA's Developmental League. But first, there was much basketball played at the men's conference tournament level last night. Winners in the ACC included Duke, 80-76 over Miami, and North Carolina, 79-67 over Virginia. Over in the Big East Conference, Syracuse slipped by Georgetown 58-57, and Pittsburgh beat Villanova 68-54. Michigan State beat Illinois 61-56, Iowa overcame Minnesota 67-57, and though the Penn State football team was very good last season, the basketball team doesn't feel so hot, and here's the reason. While they were only scoring 56, not all that great, they fell by 7 to the team we call Ohio State. I'm sorry, I couldn't help it. Joining me now on the line is Pat Forte of ESPN.com. Pat, welcome back to Only a Game.
Happy to be with you. Happy March, Bill.
Thank you. Conference tournaments aren't crucial for the success of the elite teams. They'll be high seeds in next week's NCAA tournament, regardless of how they perform in the conference tournaments. But which schools formerly on the brink of not making it to the big dance ensured themselves a trip with their performances this week?
Well, you got to start with Syracuse there. The Jerry McNamara dramatics in Madison Square Garden Wednesday and Thursday, unbelievable. You know, I think that if they had lost to Cincinnati, they would have been out, and that was, you know, truly a elimination-defying shot that he made there, and then came back with another big shot in a huge game against number one Connecticut. So they're the biggest winner I've seen so far out there.
Well, I want to talk about number one Connecticut losing early in that conference tournament. Should Jim Calhoun be worried?
Well, only because he had said going into this tournament that he really did want to win it. He had pointed out that both of his national champions did win the Big East tournament, and so I think that he thought it would be important to have a big roll of momentum coming out of Manhattan. You know, now he can turn around, obviously, and say out of the other side of his mouth, well, this doesn't really mean anything, and we'll see what's going to happen from there. It just shows, it points out that the one chink Connecticut has is they sometimes lose focus. I mean, they're the best team, they're the most talented team, but there are times where you wonder where their heads are.
Another early loser in conference tournament play was George Washington. All they had done over the course of the season is compiled the year's longest winning streak. Are they in a position to be worried, too?
Well, I think that they're vulnerable, yes. Their center, Pops Mensah-Bonsu, which if he isn't on the all-name team, I don't know who is. But Pops has been out for a couple of weeks with a knee problem, and I think that they're hoping he'll be back for the NCAA tournament. But even with him, they've went a long way. They won a lot of games, but against suspect competition. And I think a lot of people are looking at them and saying that's a team that could be vulnerable next week during the big dance.
Duke, along with UConn, seem to be up at the head of the class of this year's college basketball teams. But with recent losses, including one at home to hated North Carolina, well, one North Carolina fan told me he thought Duke looked tired. Is that what's happening in Durham?
That is the popular water cooler theory. And, you know, I think there's good reason for it. You know, one of the things Mike Krzyzewski's done, one of his strengths is also one of his weaknesses, is that he plays a very short rotation, and that keeps players happy. It gets them lots of shots and points and minutes, but at the same time, at the end of the year, they tend to wear down a little bit, and they don't have a whole lot of depth. J.J. Redick has been playing just a ton of minutes with a lot of attention and pressure on him, and he looks tired. His last four games, he hasn't shot better than 36% from the field in any one of those games. And I just think that they are a little bit worn down. What they're going to need, I wrote, in fact, that it would not be a terrible thing, I don't think, for them to almost tank the ACC tournament, play some more guys. If they lose early, fine, and then rest up for the tournament that really matters.
Speaking of UNC, the defending national champions are in the top 10. The young Tar Heels were lightly regarded after losing their top 7 scorers from last season. So do we give Roy Williams the Coach of the Year award now, or do we wait?
I'll go ahead and give it to him now, I think, Bill. It's been unbelievable. I mean, as good a coach as he is and as good as you knew the players they had coming in were, I certainly didn't foresee this. I thought they'd be middle of the pack in the ACC and have a real hard time even making the NCAA tournament. Now we could be looking, you know, at a number 2 or 3 seed for them, and it's just unbelievable. I had been advocating Bruce Pearl for Coach of the Year for a long time, and not just because of his hideous orange jackets. But I think now I've changed my mind. I got to give it to Roy and his pale blue jackets instead.
It's hard to predict how the wise and mysterious tournament selection committee will fill out the last few slots in the 65-team bracket tomorrow. But is there a school somewhere ripe for an upset in the early rounds that you can point us toward?
Well, you know, we mentioned George Washington. I think that could be one of them. You know, other teams that maybe are wobbling a little bit, Tennessee, which won the SEC East but has not been playing very well. You can maybe look out of that same conference at Alabama, another team that maybe is just kind of lost a little bit of its spark down the stretch. And you usually kind of look for those teams. And then if they're matched up against good, experienced teams that could be dangerous from lower conferences, such as a North Carolina Wilmington, who I got to see play, or some of the teams from the Missouri Valley Conference, I think we could be looking at some possible upsets there.
Of course, for every upset, Pat, there's a Cinderella team. Have you got a candidate for a school that's going to come out of nowhere and be a Cinderella team for us this time around?
Well, I like Wilmington, as I mentioned, from the Colonial Athletic Association, but another one I think could sneak up on people is South Alabama from the Sun Belt Conference. Coached by John Pelfrey, who was one of those gritty, gutty Kentucky overachievers from about 15 years ago. He's put together a very, very good team down there, very dangerous. You know, they get after you defensively and really press the tempo, very much like a Patino Billy Donovan kind of team. And they could catch somebody off guard, I think, with that style and pull an upset.
All right, Pat, I would like to talk about a subject that you broached in a recent column. Duke's J.J. Redick and Gonzaga's Adam Morrison are the two best players in college basketball. They are also white, and you have estimated in your column that this was the first time since the early 70s that that has been the case. Did this assertion wildly increase the number of emails flowing into your computer?
Funny, yes, it did. I mean, anytime you bring up race, there's generally going to be a fairly passionate response, and that column did indeed get it. And you really have to be careful treading on that ground, but I just thought that there was actual empirical reasons to write about it. Is we at least have a certifiable anomaly. It may just be a fluke. It may, you know, not repeat itself any time in this lifetime, but the fact is it's been 36 years since the two best players were white, and I think you can go on down the line that there are a significant number of white players making major impacts around the country, significant enough to note and to notice in a game that has become increasingly dominated by black kids over the years. If you look at the Big East, which everybody said by acclamation was the best conference, they had an 11-member first-team All-Big East team. And why 11? I don't know. You only put 5 on the floor. You put 11 out there for football. But 6 of those guys were white guys.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and then Redick from the ACC, Adam Morrison, from Gonzaga, Tyler Hansbrough, the National Freshman of the Year, is white. And I just thought it would be an interesting topic to explore.
Pat Forte covers college basketball, among other things, for ESPN.com. Pat, thanks again.
My pleasure. I appreciate it, Bill.
Last year, the National Developmental Basketball League announced that it would henceforth function as a sort of farm system for the NBA. Each of the NBDL's 8 teams are affiliated with 3 or 4 NBA squads, which can call players up to round out depleted rosters or send players down for rehab or more game experience. Beverly Amsler of member station WVTF in Roanoke, Virginia, reports on year one of the NBA's minor league experiment.
It's a quiet Monday morning at a school gym in Roanoke, with two members of the Roanoke Dazzle running a blocking sequence and shooting hoops. Roanoke Dazzle head coach Ken Davison looks on. He says the new arrangement lends credibility to the D-League.
I think it allows those teams to get a better feel for what that particular player is capable of doing under game conditions, because being in on their team, hey, they're trying to win games, so they're not going to get a chance maybe to play some of the younger guys. And hey, here we have a chance to try to help them develop and let them see what they're capable of doing.
He says it's better for the young players to make their mistakes in the D-League without all the pressure in the pros.
Because once you get there, you want to stay there. And you make those mistakes up there, then you may not stay. And so that's the whole idea of our league. The NBA knows there are guys that are out there that can play at that level, but they just need some experience. Hence, here we are.
Davison says it's challenging to keep the team consistently in the win column, with players being called up to the NBA while others are coming down. Fayetteville Patriots head coach Mike Brown agrees.
That's why it is the NBA Development League. You know, it's to develop guys. You're going to have guys that shuffled in and out from NBA guys, from guys getting called up, from guys getting injured, and guys coming back from overseas. But if you have the opportunity that you have with a guy to be able to help develop him and work on a certain part of his game, and he improves, you know, as a coach, your job is accomplished.
Brown says the constant movement of players is why the NBA doesn't place a major emphasis on wins and losses. Isaiah Victor of the Roanoke Dazzle has never played for an NBA team. He says it can be tough watching teammates get called up, but only if you let it bother you.
It depends on your mindset. You have to come into this knowing that. That's what this league is for. Everybody's trying to get out of this league. They should be trying to improve as much as they can every day, and then at the end they should be trying to get out of here. And when that happens, when you see guys playing well or, you know, been with certain teams and then certain teams need a certain kind of player, you kind of know, you know, people are not going to last. Even some guys even go overseas and things like that. But that's just a part of minor league ball. And
Victor says when there's a hole in the roster, it's time for others, such as himself, to step up their game. Boston Celtics number one pick Gerald Green has spent time with the Fayetteville Patriots and Florida Flame during his rookie season. He's currently with Boston, but while in the D-League, he said he'd been working on his basketball IQ and his defense.
It's a good opportunity for me to play, you know, get a lot of experience, get a lot of development going in my life, because, you know, I'm young, I came out of high school, and I think there's a lot of stuff to learn, and I think I'll be going to the D-League, I can learn a lot of stuff.
Green scored 13 points and grabbed 9 rebounds in a February 22nd game against the Phoenix Suns. Another Boston draft pick, Will Bynum, is spending his rookie year in Roanoke focusing on the point guard position, which he didn't play at Georgia Tech. He said the D-League has helped with more than just his game.
Off the court, I mean, with the seminars and everything that they got going on, when we go out of town and we have meetings with each other and we're talking about drugs and just all different type of things about getting back in school. I mean, it just helped me out so much, and I'm maturing as a player on and off the court.
Thanks for a great game, Dazzle!
Basketball fans seem to enjoy the new arrangement between the NBA and the D-League. Phil Foster follows college basketball and has been a season ticket holder since the Roanoke Dazzle came to town 5 years ago. He enjoys watching future NBA players fine-tune their craft.
They've got a lot of potential, and as I've told some of them and talking to them, I wish them the best. I hope they can go up, and I hope we don't see them again. Because, it's, you know, they can go to the big game then, and like Mikey Moore a couple of years ago, he's still playing, I think, with the Sonics. And so we got some players here to, in this game, both sides, they'll probably have a chance to go up.
Fayetteville Patriots coach Mike Brown played in the NBA for 11 seasons. He wishes there had been a developmental league during his playing days.
It's a great idea, and you would have much more developed guys, you know, now. You know, people complain, you know, the guys don't make as many shots, or the game gets a little sloppy in the NBA. You would have much better players, and then also players are coming out younger and younger. So they're losing that college, you know, time of really learning how to play and growing as a young man. Now they're just kind of thrown to the sharks. So they get it all at one time. So it's a lot for a young man to handle. So the D-League is very good for that.
NBA Commissioner David Stern has recently announced that a ninth D-League team will begin play next season in Bakersfield, California, to be called the Jam. Most coaches predict the D-League will eventually grow to 15 franchises, allowing two NBA teams to be affiliated with each. Coach Brown says the future is very bright for the D-League.
David Stern is developing this into an exact minor league for the NBA. Not at this moment, not as sophisticated as Major League Baseball, you know, but it's heading down that right track.
But the future could be less bright for Fayetteville and Roanoke. The NBA will review those franchises at the end of this season and decide if they'll stay or if they'll fold. For Only a Game, I'm Beverly Amsler in Roanoke, Virginia.
Matthew. You're listening to Only a Game. On the last day of the Winter Olympics, Sue Schaupner, a WBUR listener, mused in an email to Only a Game as follows: "One question has been nagging me. Why is there no women's ski jumping?" Ms. Schaupner may not have long to wait. An organization called Women Ski Jumpers USA has been publicizing the fact that ski jumping is the only Winter Olympic sport in which women aren't competing. They are lobbying to change that circumstance. Canadian officials want women's ski jumping at the 2010 Games in Vancouver, and more than a year ago, Norway requested the event for the 2007 World Ski Jumping Championships in Japan. In response to our story last week about a sled dog race, Sharon Miller, who hears the program on WCBE in Columbus, Ohio, emailed to say, "My Shiba Inus say thanks for the show on the Yukon Quest. They were barking and howling along with the dogs in the background of the story. What an exciting Saturday morning." Anyone inclined to email this week that Only a Game has gone to the dogs should please restrain him or herself. Curtis Harris of Hillsborough, New Hampshire, emailed this week to say, "Last Saturday I was listening to your show while taking my daughter to her weekly Saturday morning bowling league. We were psyched to hear your story about college women's bowling. More bowling stories, please." Daniel Jones also responded to Karen Givens' bowling story. "Instead of simply celebrating the Nebraska bowling team and talking about the growth of bowling as an NCAA sport," he wrote, "you include a sidebar about the men who bowl on a club team and talk about the disparity. I guess it really is tough to be a man in today's society." Perhaps the week's most passionate email came from Beth Wigner, who hears Only a Game on KCUR in Kansas City, home of the Negro Leagues Museum and Hall of Fame. Like Charlie Pierce, Ms. Wigner thinks those who vote people into the Baseball Hall of Fame in Cooperstown should have elected Buck O'Neill. "Oh, we are mad here in Kansas City," she wrote. "We thought he was the perfect candidate. Thanks for your comments. The Baseball Hall of Fame is going to be hearing from a lot of people, I hope." I hope we'll be hearing from a lot of people, too, whether or not they're mad at us. You can reach us through our website, onlyagame.org. Our email address is onlyagame@wbur.bu.edu. Or you can leave a message on the listener line by calling 617-353-1860. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, by the Dairy Farm families who own Cabot Creamery, five generations of farming and making naturally aged cheddar cheese in Vermont, on the web at cabotcheese.com, and Bicon Dental Implants, offering short implants that can eliminate the need for bone grafting, available at the Implant Dentistry Center at bicon.com, bicon.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, I'll take the high road and you take a strike and hit to right. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a discussion of the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, Bill.
We all woke Thursday morning to the happy news that the NFL as we know it will, in fact, endure for at least the next 6 years. How did the multimillionaire owners manage to come to an agreement with the multibillionaire owners?
Well, they managed to get the defibrillator paddles on the Golden Goose just in time. there's a couple of interesting things. First of all, there's clearly a divide in football ownership similar to the alleged divide in baseball ownership, which we never saw before. It was a very well-hidden fault line through the structure of the sport. So I have a feeling that basically a lot of what the Players Association side of this did was sit back and let the owners hash this out among themselves. They got a pretty decent deal out of the case. The revenue sharing on local revenues was the important sticking point. It seems like people like Bob Kraft, the owner of the New England Patriots, and others who have a lot of local revenue stepped up. They will argue for the good of the league. Everyone else would argue because they didn't want to look like silly people in front of the world, and got a deal done. And I think once again you're going to see a lot of stuff comparing this to the way baseball does things.
Your interpretation would suggest that the union didn't necessarily step up and get more powerful suddenly than it had ever been before because it didn't have to. This was owner v. owner.
I think if the owners are squabbling among themselves, then yes, the NFLPA is stronger than it was before the owners started squabbling among themselves, if only by the enemy of my enemy is my friend theory.
The Defense Department announced this week that it will reinvestigate the death of Pat Tillman, the former NFL player who died as a result of so-called friendly fire in Afghanistan. This is at least the fourth official investigation, and it's already been established that the Army initially lied about Tillman's death. What more is there to investigate?
Well, they're going to try to bring criminal charges against whoever it was killed them. This is a testimony to Pat Tillman's family, especially his parents, who have kept this story alive against all the spin and all the dishonesty that is the hallmark of this administration's military policies from day one. They tried to make Pat Tillman into Jessica Lynch. His family wouldn't let them do it. Now they're going to get the investigation they should have had in the first place. And I think you see where Pat Tillman got the strength of character he demonstrated by joining the Army in the first place. It came from his folks.
Excerpts of a new book about Barry Bonds and his alleged use of steroids were published in Sports Illustrated this week. Charlie, have these allegations, the way they've been presented in the press, et cetera, changed the way you view Bonds?
I never had a particular view of Barry Bonds one way or the other. I believe that there was that the evidence as presented prior to the last couple of weeks was insufficient in my mind to justify a decision either way. This I'm starting to tend a little bit in the other direction now. That having been said, if he actually did testify to the grand jury that he didn't know what this stuff was and that he didn't do any of this stuff, as I've heard the allegations prove to be true, I'm looking for a criminal case here. I'm tired of prosecutors who chicken out and then wind up trying their cases in the press, even if they get a guilty verdict in the press, which the prosecutors who leaked to these authors apparently did. If this guy has done as much as he is alleged to have done, then he perjured himself in the grand jury, and I want him in jail. And if you can't put him in jail, then don't expect a 100% respect from me on what you leak to people.
Major League Baseball, that champion of free enterprise, has developed a new way to address the performance-enhancing drug issue. From now on, players can buy their supplements directly from Major League Baseball and the W.S. Walcott Medicine Show wagon. Why didn't they think of this 30 years ago?
What is God? This is, I mean, yes, it probably, I mean, if you look upon this as like a consumer safety issue, which I don't, by the way, because I don't believe I rode to the studios today on a unicorn, then it makes sense. Major League Baseball will, you know, the crack medical legal staff of Major League Baseball will vet these supplements and certify them as being safe for use. I thought using anything to improve your performance was quote unquote cheating. What is Major League Baseball doing here?
Making a profit.
Turning into one of those places you see at the mall with the balloon bicep guy out front holding a little bottle saying, "You can look like me."
Here's a candidate for the least likely baseball headline of the week. U.S. rallies but can't overcome 8-0 hole versus Canada. Not, I repeat, not a hockey headline.
Hey, not only that, the United States of America was almost mercy ruled out of the World Baseball Classic. Two more runs and the United States of America would have been sent home like a really bad T-ball team.
David Wells, who announced last week that he wanted to stay with the Red Sox after all, announced this week that Commissioner Bud Selig should resign. What do you suppose he'll announce next week?
Well, he said more than that. He said that Commissioner Bud Selig was a piece of expletive. So I will quote him on that, and thank you, David. But he did say something else. He said, Bud has a hard time leaving Milwaukee. Listen, David, everyone has a hard time leaving Milwaukee. Once you've been to the Paris on the Menominee, it's very hard to go back to where you're from.
The Major League Soccer franchise in Houston, briefly known as 1836, is now the Houston Dynamo. As of Thursday, the team formerly known as the New York, New Jersey Metro Stars became Red Bull New York. Is this really the best way for a league to keep itself in the news during its offseason?
Hey, it's your league, pal.
I know, and I am sort of shocked. This is the best they can do to keep soccer in the news.
Why don't they just change every team's name in the league to Clown College and be over with?
There's a World Cup coming up. Come on, there's plenty of reasons to keep
soccer. Are they changing the names of countries? I mean, we did that when the Soviet Union fell. We managed to get through it.
Wellington, New Zealand Mayor John Hurley wants a nude cycling race there called off. Is he a champion of decency, or is there another motive here?
He's afraid because they're not wearing helmets. That would be so far down on my list of concerns when it comes to nude cycling. I would gladly trade a helmet for armor and almost any other part of my body if I was riding my bicycle naked, as I would point out most passersby would.
The great disadvantage to playing cricket in a very cold place would
seem to be
that the games take too long, and who wants to be out in the cold for a very long time? But according to the cricketers currently playing in Estonia during the winter, that's not the only disadvantage. What other challenges did they face?
A challenge that is probably not unfamiliar to Mayor John Hurley. All the balls froze.
And finally, Charlie, the Winter Olympics did not attract the audience NBC had hoped that the network would capture. Now a fellow named Shane Igo has revealed a plan to address that problem. How do you like it?
I can't listen to this guy's name without thinking about the two bumbling brothers on the old Rocky show, Hugo and Igo Bumbling.
Yeah.
He thinks they should take the Olympics to Hoth, the ice planet from The Empire Strikes Back, the second movie in the previous good Star Wars trilogy as opposed to the lame Star Wars trilogy.
Oh, the letters we'll get.
I think Shane Igo should move himself to Estonia and try to deal with the frozen ball issue first.
Charlie Fierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine and joins me each week at this time. Thank you, Charlie.
Thanks, Bill.
To send comments about what you've heard on Only a Game, rifle through our voluminous audio archives, or see what our cameras have captured when we're in the field, please visit onlyagame.org. The emerald diamond. The phrase might describe the tidy bright grass of any green spring training ball yard, especially now as baseball gets underway again in Florida and Arizona. But the most recent incarnation of emerald diamond refers to baseball on the Emerald Isle, which would be Ireland. And that gives me the opportunity to speak with John Fitzgerald, who sounds as if he should be Irish. He's the director of a new movie about baseball in Ireland entitled Emerald Diamond. And he joins me now in the studio. John Fitzgerald, welcome to Only a Game.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
As most of our listeners are likely to be surprised that there is any baseball in Ireland, tell me how the phenomenon came to your attention.
I actually found a website, and it was a big surprise to me as well. And from the website, I decided to train for the Irish national team, and found out later from the Irish embassy that I wasn't eligible to play. So at that point, I knew all the stories. I had emailed the coaches and talked to them on the phone for about 3 or 4 months. And, I heard stories about how these guys came through every imaginable obstacle, and I thought it would be a great story to put on film.
Well, speaking of obstacles, correct me if I'm wrong, but when the first group of Irish ball players gathered to form a team, which was only about a decade ago, the number of baseball fields in Ireland was exactly zero, right?
Exactly zero, and the number of bases and backstops and anything you would actually associate with baseball being a necessity was zero. So growing up in America, you would never imagine being able to play baseball without a field in the rain that these guys go through with no equipment. It's pretty incredible to see what these guys have done.
Your film follows the first Irish baseball team into the B group of the European Championships, where they are not especially successful. But for some of the players, winning isn't really the point, or at least it isn't the only point. Here's how one of them characterizes the experience of traveling to Croatia for that tournament.
You would look around, you'd see all the buildings. It's like bullets or mortar damage or whatever. I was going about taking pictures of it all, and, you know, all the guys were saying, that must be like back in Belfast, you know, what are you taking pictures of that for, you know?
One of the things that was really scarily prevalent was everywhere you went, there was a complete lack of young men, of anybody from the high teens into the low 20s. When you went out at night, there was very few young men anywhere. Anytime we went to a nightclub, it was absolutely packed with older guys and girls. There was just this very strange and actually unnerving lack of men our own age. And basically, they were all in military service or, unfortunately, dead.
It would seem that paying attention to baseball might have been difficult for any of the visiting players, but especially for a player who's reminded of home by what he sees.
That was the first voice you heard there was Terry Rosebotham, who the only player at the time from Belfast on the Irish national team. And obviously, it hit home for all these guys. To see that kind of devastation. But for him, it really reminded him of obviously, all the stories you've heard of Belfast about the war over there. And he saw it as an opportunity to really remind himself of how proud he was to play for Ireland.
What is the state currently of Irish baseball vis-a-vis other teams outside of North America, Latin America, and Asia, where baseball obviously is tremendously popular?
Well, baseball's growing in popularity in Ireland and throughout Europe, but what I found was that even though it is growing, there is a lack of media attention out there, but the youth baseball program is amazing. They actually have programs in County Cork and County Kerry where, you know, they'll start with 10 kids. Within 2 weeks, there's like a couple of hundred kids just showing up at the field. They know nothing about baseball. They've seen it on TV a couple of times maybe, but they just want to play and they want to learn the game. And that's really where I think Europe and Ireland specifically have a great opportunity to really grow the game.
As baseball in Ireland has developed, the game that you chronicle has become a bit less Irish. The Irish team began importing U.S. players who had the odd grandparent from Cork or Kilkenny. Is that a good thing?
Yeah, I think it is, because it allows the guys from Ireland to play with and against better competition. But they do have a rule that three-quarters of the team has to be born in Ireland. Mm-hmm. Because they don't want to dilute the entire team, you know, just make it all American. There are other countries that will do that, and that really stunts the growth of the youth baseball program, because they want the kids in Ireland to see, you know, a progression where if I play baseball and I'm 10 years old or I'm 15 years old, when I'm 20, I can play on the national team and I won't have a guy from America come and take my job. So it's very important to them to make sure that three-quarters of the players are actually born in Ireland.
But you can be born in Ireland and then go over and attend Boston College and come back and play.
Sure you can, yeah, yeah.
I want to listen to another bit of the movie. We're hearing from a player here, and I don't know to what extent his comment reflects the feelings of all of his teammates about what baseball requires.
Baseball is a game where, you know, you don't have to be, you have a certain amount of athleticism required, but the main thing is about being relaxed, right? So if you've had a few drinks the night before and you turn up a little sleep, you can actually be very relaxed.
Now, did you hesitate at all to include that opinion in the movie?
No, that's actually the team captain, and the thing about him is he gives you some great sound bites, and he's a great guy as far as joking around and everything, but he's completely serious on the field. So when you see it in the context of the film, you realize that a lot of that was really tongue-in-cheek, and there have been occasions where they went out and, you know, celebrated a victory maybe a bit too long, or thought that they were done and they had no chance to win, so they went out and just partied a little bit too long. But I think there are two occasions where I can think that that actually happened in 10 years. So they have a very good nature about the whole thing, but they joke about it, and it's a lot more serious than they let on. They're very self-deprecating.
John, as we speak, teams from countries where baseball has been established for generations are competing in the World Baseball Classic, the first tournament of that name. Do the Irish players dare to aspire to that level, or are they still thinking in terms of playing Croatia and Romania and teams like that?
Well, they have to be realistic about the whole thing, but obviously, you know, it would be a dream of theirs to make it to the Olympics or to the World Baseball Classic. And, you know, that may be about 10 years off, maybe more, but that's definitely a goal. And one of the things I've done is put video clips on the film's website from Paul Archie, who actually is in charge of the World Baseball Classic, just to kind of explain where Ireland stands in the European community as far as, you know, development of the game and, you know, who are the European powerhouses. You know, Italy and the Netherlands are the teams that Ireland will have to beat to make it to the Classic. So, you know, just to kind of give like a frame of reference, because most people don't actually know that they play in Europe.
I guess one measure of progress is toward the end of your film, there is a player identified who is kind of maybe sort of a major league prospect.
Yeah, Rory Murphy is he's an 18-year-old catcher and born and raised in Dublin. And he's got the skills to at least play college ball. But Paul Archie, the head of the Baseball Classic, identifies him as the first main prospect that scouts may actually be interested in Ireland. And we've got a clip of that in the movie, and it shows how far these guys have come in 10 years.
Tough, though, to become a prospect when you don't have the opportunity as a youngster to play against high-level competition on a consistent basis.
Exactly, and that's the main concern, because he's also a tremendous rugby player, and he's obviously playing against the best competition over there. And then he goes and plays baseball against maybe not the best competition, and now it's kind of up to him. Is he going to play rugby, or is he going to come to the U.S. to play a little bit of baseball to return to Ireland as their first professional or college ball player?
John Fitzgerald is the director of The Emerald Diamond, a film about baseball in Ireland, which will be showing soon in Washington, D.C., Milwaukee, and Chicago, among other baseball venues. John, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Well, thanks very much for having me.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Gabe O'Connor. Our technical director is John Ferrati. We had help this week from Gabrielle Scruggs. Our senior producer is Gary Wallach. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287, toll free. CDs and cassettes are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. If you'd like to learn more about the Emerald Diamond, listen to stories past and present, or sign up for our newsletter, please visit onlyagame.org. Our final word comes from our own Charlie Pierce, who dares tread where only David Wells has heretofore dared to trespass.
And we can quote him on that, so I'll quote him on that. Bud Selig is a piece of you can believe that.
Thanks, Charlie. We beat you to it. I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, the W.K. Kellogg Foundation, from vision to innovative impact, 75 years of philanthropy, the Melville Charitable Trust, supporting efforts to find and fight the causes of homelessness, on the web at melvilletrust.org, and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, continuing support of individual creativity with the announcement of new MacArthur Fellows on September 20th. This is NPR, National Public Radio.